Hello, my name is Ray Jefferson, and you're listening to Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU FM. This program is a partnership between KWBU and Creative Waco, where we discuss arts and culture and the ways they're taking shape in our city. Later in this episode, you'll hear a segment called David in Art with David Smith. Before we get started, I want to share about a few changes that have taken place at Creative Waco in the last month and a half or so. I really enjoyed the 2 years that I've spent with the incredible staff at Creative Waco and in the arts community here in our city, but I am excited to announce that I'm now serving as a communications director of the Family Health Center here in Waco. So I am switching gears a little bit, not doing so much of art and working in healthcare, but I'm really excited about the new opportunities. This doesn't mean that Conversations with Creative Waco is coming to an end. We're excited to start our second year of programming and are already ready to sit down with even more locals who have become leaders of the creative community here in our city. But this does mean that you'll be hearing a new voice in Conversations from time to time. Her name is Kennedy Sam, and she's the new Marketing and Communications Director at Creative Waco. I'm here with Executive Director Fiona Bond, as well as Kennedy. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Ray.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. So I want to start things off by letting Kennedy share a little bit about her background with us. Can you tell us what you were doing before you joined Creative Waco?
So before I joined Creative Waco, I really just graduated from college. In May of 2018, I graduated from LSU. Go Tigers! So through there, I studied mass communication with my concentration in public relations, and okay. I had a minor in business. So that whole time that I was in college, I was like, I really don't know what I want to do, but I just love communications and marketing. So, I mean, I kind of tailored, my internships throughout college within the nonprofit sector and then a little bit of the higher ed, but I really just love the nonprofit. So that's kind of how I got into this industry. And then, upon graduation, I still didn't know what I wanted to do or where I wanted to go, like what city I wanted to choose. So I was in a bit of a gray area for a while where I was just freelancing, doing social media for a couple coffee shops and my mom's business. But I finally came back home and I was like, all right, it's time to get serious. What do you want to do? And I just so happened to stumble upon this opportunity, and that's how I ended up with Creative Waco.
Awesome. I know Fiona is excited to have you.
Absolutely. And I think Kennedy is selling herself a little short there because she comes with really impressive chops, having done communications and marketing for a number of really prestigious organizations as an intern and on her way up. And we were very impressed at how well she communicated to us the need for communication.
So, Kennedy, you're a Waco native, correct?
I would say so. Okay. I've been here since I was 5 and I'm 22 now.
Yeah, I think that qualifies you.
Yeah, so, I mean, all my memories are Waco. I started at Hillcrest PDS and I went to Tennyson and then graduated in 2014 from Waco High. So, I mean, yeah, I'm as Waco can be.
That's awesome. Did you ever think that you'd find yourself working here after graduation?
No, I didn't. When I was in high school, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get out of Waco. I can't wait to get out of Texas. And then I just go a state over and end up like, oh, I miss going home. Break, it would be like, all right, let's go home. Like, I miss my friends. The main thing that really, hurt my heart about being away from Waco and Texas in general, it was just the food.
So what do you find appealing about Creative Waco and the kinds of work that you get to do here?
So while I was in college, like I really kind of fell off of what was going on in the community. But when I came back, I know Creative Waco was a relatively new organization. Mm-hmm. So it's what drew me to it is that there's nothing else in the community like it.
Yeah.
I know you guys started with Arts Alliance, and at that point, that's like the only time that there was really a central organization that could bring together the arts community. And I feel like Creative Waco has the special little, I don't know, it's like the diamond in the sky that can just bring together and kind of uplift all the cultural aspects of this community that's kind of on the back end and doesn't get as much recognition, especially right now.
Sure.
I'm excited to join this team, and I'm excited to see what we can do.
Awesome. We're really, really happy that you're here. Fiona, can you talk about the importance of communications in arts and arts programming?
Yes, and I actually have to pay tribute to Kennedy here because she was the one who said this during the interview process. And those of us who heard her talking about communication and why she thinks it's important, we're really struck that this is really true, that she spent a lot of time traveling in different places. And she was saying that connectivity between people is so important. And it's no matter what you're doing, what sphere you're doing it in, there's, unless you can effectively communicate what you're doing and why to the people that you're trying to reach, there's kind of no point in doing it. You're doing it in a vacuum.
Sure.
And we feel that really acutely, that one of the things that we have as our core mission with Creative Waco is to grow Waco as a cultural hub, as a cultural destination. And to do that, we need to be really good at making sure that we communicate how fantastic our cultural assets are. We need to make sure we signpost people doing great things. We need to make sure that our own population within Waco knows the extent of activities and events that are happening, and that people who are doing those things have good vehicles for making sure they communicate what they're doing to the wider world.
Thank you so much, Fiona and Kennedy, for sharing your thoughts. Kennedy, I, along with the Creative Waco team, are really excited to have you here in the arts community. So congratulations on your new position.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Now it's time for this week's edition of David and Art with David Smith.
A culture prone to see works of art as offensive or insulting will eventually erode the creative impulse that makes the culture vibrant. Here's David Smith with this week's edition of David and Art on KWBU.
Sometimes I wonder if art can survive at all. In a culture more attuned than ever to insults, it's easy to take personal offense at a work of art, make that offense known to the world, and insist that the art be removed. The latest version of all this began playing out last month when the Los Angeles public school system ran into trouble over a mural at one of its campuses. In 2016, artist Bo Stanton painted a 30 by 40 foot mural at LA's Robert F. Kennedy Community Schools complex, which occupies the former site of the historic Ambassador Hotel, where RFK was assassinated in 1968. The mural is a vibrant composition featuring a profile of actress Ava Gardner and tropical elements that reference the hotel's famous Coconut Grove nightclub that was a Hollywood favorite from the 20s to the 60s. The background is blue and orange sun rays that radiate outward toward the edges. And that's where the trouble eventually began. Korean groups now say that the background is too much like the rising sun motif of the Imperial Japanese Army flag from World War II. Therefore, the design is as offensive to them as a swastika would be to Jews. A spokesman for the group even compared the mural to a hate crime and threatened legal action if officials didn't get rid of it. Immediately, the school district agreed and said it would be painted over during the winter break. But then the counter-protest erupted. The LA Times and the National Coalition Against Censorship condemned the decision, and Robert F. Kennedy's sons even weighed in, invoking the memory of their father and their uncle to defend the mural. As fiercely as they supported tolerance and diversity, my father and my uncle loathed censorship, one said. For his part, Stanton defended his artistic decisions. Radial lines terminating at a focal point are a common design choice with a long history, he said, and he threatened to sue the district if it went forward with its plan. His fellow artist Shepard Fairey, most famous for the red and blue Hope poster that he created for the Barack Obama campaign, said that if the school district painted over Stanton's mural, he would remove his own popular mural of Robert Kennedy that he painted at the school in 2016, too. What's more, he told the school board president that he would ask students at the school to help him paint over it as a symbol of the sacrifices that are sometimes necessary to stand up for important principles. The district was no doubt surprised by the chorus of disapproval and immediately reversed its course and put plans to destroy the mural on hold. There is a need to have additional conversation, it said. That's where the matter still stands as students return to class from their winter break. How this winds up is anyone's guess, but if you care about art, it's worth watching carefully.
This and past episodes can be found on our website at kwbu.org. Just look for David and Art under the Programs tab.
Welcome to Shout, Black Gospel Music Moments. I'm Robert Darden. Gospel singer Sally Martin was there in the beginning. Thomas Dorsey may have been the so-called father of gospel music, but it was Martin's business genius that enabled his new fusion of spirituals and the blues to sweep the nation in the early 1930s. Martin was also a fine singer herself. She had a plain, unadorned, but absolutely believable style, and wowed churches wherever she went, recording into the early 1980s. Sally and Thomas Dorsey had a prickly relationship, but they occasionally performed together on special occasions, including a tribute album from 1973 where they recorded Dorsey's famous "I'll Tell It Wherever I Go." It's one of the few recordings we have of Dorsey playing the piano in that old barrel house style. It may say 1973 on the label, but their rendition is strictly from the late 1920s, and all the more memorable for that.
I'll tell it wherever I go. I count every blessing. I go on confessing. I'll tell it wherever I go. The life is uncertain, I cannot understand, but thank Him and trust Him and praise Him while I can. I'll just tell it.
I'm Robert Darden. Shout! Black Gospel Music Moments is produced by KWBU, the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University Libraries, and is funded by generous support from the Pritchard Foundation.
You're listening to Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU FM. I'm your host, Ray Jefferson. Today in the studio, we have Chuck Jennings, who is a professional guitarist based out of Waco. Chuck is an incredibly talented musician who leads jazz jam sessions on the last Wednesday of the month at the downtown gallery and event space Cultivate 712. The sessions provide a unique opportunity for amateur musicians to play alongside professionals in a relaxed environment, and it's unlike any other regularly occurring music event here in our community. Chuck, thanks for being here today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I always like to start things off by learning a little bit about our guests before we really get into the bulk of the conversation. So you've been a full-time musician for nearly 38 years. Can you tell us a little bit about how you even took up music?
Well, I started playing guitar when I was 14 years old. I took lessons for about a month, did not like them at all, and I quit. But in a way, I think I learned one of my most important lessons there, because the teacher told my mom that I would never be able to play the guitar. So that's something I've always kept in mind for my own teaching, is that, you know, I never know exactly where anybody is, and no matter how they might seem at the moment, I don't know what the future holds for them. So I basically just taught myself to play until I went to college, and I went to a regular college for about 2 years, and I studied classical guitar there because it was the only thing they really had. But I dropped out of school, took a year off, and sort of discovered jazz music, and decided to go to Berklee College of Music in Boston, which is sort of the leading jazz school.
Sure.
And after graduation from there, I just started working as a musician. I was in Boston for about 10 years, and then I moved to Los Angeles. I was there for 11 years, and then I was in New York from 2000 to 2016.
Wow, that's amazing. So you've lived in pretty much the biggest cities you can.
Yeah, it's sort of the most demanding music scenes
sure.
in the country.
Did you find those fulfilling for you?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
What do you find compelling about jazz?
Well, I think just primarily aside from just the sort of the beauty of the music itself, it's primarily the improvisational aspect of
okay.
it, which was what sort of attracted me to music in the first place. I was very aware that even the rock guitar players that I liked were improvising.
Can you talk about what it's like to be a musician in a larger city like that? You know, what does it look like to be able to get gigs? You know, how does that kind of play out?
Well, it's a struggle to pay the bills, for one thing, because generally the cost of living is very high. It's tremendously high in New York. Los Angeles is very high. And gigs don't always pay so much, so it's a constant hustle. You always have to have to be looking for gigs, and it's a lot of business involved.
Can you talk about what it's like to do this kind of work in a city of this size, especially after leaving a bigger market like those?
Well, when I first moved here, I actually thought I would probably be spending all my time in Dallas and Austin. But, I mean, surprisingly, there's a number of good musicians here. And I've been able to work most of the time in Waco. I play in Austin more than Dallas, but there's a pretty good crew here.
Yeah, that's awesome. How often would you say you have gigs here in Waco?
Well, every week, a couple times a week. Sure. I mean, most of the gigs here are only on the weekends because there's really no audience during the week for the most part. So.
Okay, cool. Have you enjoyed being a full-time musician here?
Yeah, it's been pretty good.
Okay, good. So let's talk about jazz jams. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of jam sessions and kind of the importance they play for musicians?
Well, I think historically, people who became jazz musicians, or as jazz evolved, it was generally people who were professional musicians in towns, and they were the people who, you know, before internet, before TV, when people used to go out, they were the people who provided the entertainment in nightclubs or for theaters or for those types of things. And so they were playing generally very in a restricted format, or something that would be, you know, just considered like a very commercial music kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So after hours, it became like an after hours thing. When they would get off work, they would go somewhere and to where they could play the music that they wanted to play.
Sure.
So that's sort of the genesis of it. And as jazz came along, which is a very improvisational music, it became even more important for them to get together. It's a very social thing. It depends on interaction between musicians. So it's just something that has evolved and has become a real standard part of the jazz sort of experience.
Sure. So have you been participating in jam sessions the entire time you've been a musician?
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah. Okay. And I've been in generally what we'll do at a jazz jam session, we'll have what we call a house band.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a guitar, bass, and drums, piano, whatever, saxophone, whoever's in it. And they will form the core of the evening, and then people will come and play with them.
So are they playing music that other artists would already know, or are they just kind of riffing off of each other, just making stuff up as they go?
Well, jazz functions, there's a pretty general repertoire that jazz musicians are all familiar with. So generally, we just draw on that kind of standard repertoire.
So how did the jazz jam sessions begin at Cultivate?
Well, I work a lot with piano player Dave Wild, and we had talked about it for a really long time. And finally, when I started curating the music at Cultivate, and we were doing the Wednesday sound sessions, it just seemed like we had the space, we had the opportunity to do it. So we decided to go ahead and give it a try there.
Yeah, sounds like a good plan.
Yeah.
So who performs with you guys, like, in the house band?
Well, the regular house band is Dave Wild on piano, Dr. Ed Taylor from Baylor on drums, and myself on guitar. We've had a couple of different bass players. We haven't had a real regular bass player. But currently we have Jonathan King from Baylor.
So we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but can you walk us through a jam session and kind of describe for somebody who isn't, you know, playing what it's like to kind of be in the middle of that?
Right. Well, it kind of starts off just like a gig, like a band that you would go to see. Mm-hmm. And the house band will perform we've been performing for an hour. I think we're going to cut that down to about a half an hour. And then we just basically we have a sign-up sheet. Just put your name, what instrument you play, and then I kind of organize bands in a way. You know, I'll say, you know, you come up and play drums, you come play piano or whatever. Oh. So it depends on who's there that evening. And I just kind of put it together. If, you know, we have the house band there, so if, say, we don't have another bass player or something, then the house band bass player plays.
Okay. So who like when you have that many musicians in one space, who's controlling the flow of the music and kind of the direction that things are going in?
The musicians themselves are.
Okay.
And that's part of the jazz thing, is that you take people who have maybe never played together, maybe never even met each other before that moment. I mean, I've been in jam sessions with, you know, in New York and Los Angeles, where you might be on stage with people who don't even speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
But we know the repertoire, we know the vocabulary, And all we need to do is say this song and people know what their sort of function is.
Yeah. So when you are playing with musicians who aren't as experienced as you, how do you go about creating an environment where they feel comfortable trying new things despite the gaps that exist between your skills and theirs?
Well, that can be a problem depending on the level of the players. Mm-hmm. It used to be really demanding, like in New York. My brother's a piano player in New York, and he told me when he first moved there, he went to the jam session at the Blue Note, waited for 3 hours, and this is when they started at like 1 a.m.
Wow.
And he had been in the club. He got up to play at about 2 a.m. The band leader called a tune. He didn't know the tune, so they just kicked him off the stage.
Oh, <gosh. laughs>
So it used to be very demanding, but it's not. We're a lot gentler than
okay,
that.
Okay, that's good.
we try to find a consensus for people, something that we can all agree on. And yeah, sometimes it's just the levels are going to be different. And,
sure.
But that's part of the learning process for, particularly for the younger musicians, and that's that they get the opportunity to play with us. But we try to be pretty gentle.
Sure.
It used to be a pretty harsh thing sometimes. Mm-hmm. It used to be a very competitive. It could be kind of cold.
Yeah. Have you had any experiences like that in jam sessions that you were part of?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I've been yelled at plenty of times. Yes. No. Yes.
Yeah.
So now I get to yell at people.
So I kind of wanted to go back to something you said earlier in the program. The fact that you taught yourself how to basically play jazz guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that these jam sessions were a place where you were able to pick up things that you didn't necessarily know, while you were teaching yourself this music?
Maybe not as much to pick up things, but to put them in practice.
Okay.
To put things in. And certainly to learn a lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certain things you can't learn about jazz in a practice room.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do it on the bandstand.
So have you seen young musicians benefiting from the jam sessions at Cultivate?
Those that come, yes.
Yeah.
And even some old musicians.
Yeah. Do you find yourself growing more as a musician when you're participating in events like this?
Oh, sure, sure. Okay. I'm always growing for everything I do. It's an opportunity for growth. It's always, no matter what it is, it's always an opportunity to grow.
Yeah. What are kind of your hopes for the future of the jazz community here in Waco?
Well, I mean, to expand, I think one of the things that jazz is very, it's a very New York central sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
which it has its good points and its bad points. It's the best people from all over the world go to New York to be in an environment where, as an improvisational thing, if I'm playing with somebody who plays at my level or above, it pushes me.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is people from towns like Waco or other places who are the best musicians in town, they don't get the challenge here that they need.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of people. New York is full of people from Waco or little towns in Europe or wherever that have gone for the challenge. So I think the thing that we need – And I was talking to my wife about this the other day, is that we've lost a lot of regionalism in the jazz world. There used to be like a Kansas City jazz scene, a New Orleans jazz scene, a Detroit jazz scene. And they have different sounds, those things. So we've kind of really lost that. And I think that's something that we could really use a reemergence of.
Sure.
It's just insanely expensive to live in New York. And places like Waco offer a lot of different things that people can take advantage of here. But we really need to develop and retain musicians here.
Sure. So I think that's really interesting what you just said about, the regional nature of jazz in the past. What do you think has kind of caused that to go away?
I'm not sure exactly, but New York has just become such a center that – I mean, when I was there, everybody I played with was from Asia, Europe,
yeah.
South America, and then everywhere in the country. It's just become such a focal point. And I think because you need – it's a music that needs personal interaction.
Okay.
You know, if you're a singer-songwriter, you can live anywhere. You can write songs in your room and go out and do it. Mm-hmm. But an improvising jazz musician has to have other people to play with.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. And that's the main thing we suffer from here. We have a certain amount of people here, but I use the sports analogy of, like, we have a very good starting lineup, mm-hmm. and then the bench is – it drops off, you know?
Okay.
And we need more people.
Yeah.
We need more people, and we need more good people here.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts about how to make that happen?
Well, we're trying.
With events like the jam sessions.
Yes, yes. Yeah, we're trying. And just by, more venues are opening, too, that
sure.
have jazz. So that helps because, of course, you know, there's places where people can work and can make a living. And that certainly helps people to want to be here.
Yeah. Do you feel that whenever so I'm thinking in terms of maybe folks who don't listen to jazz normally, mm-hmm. Do you think that it takes a different way of listening to music to enjoy jazz as compared to, you know, maybe top 40 music that's on the radio or, you know, something like that? Do you think that there's just kind of a different way of approaching music to be able to appreciate jazz?
I think almost any sort of what I would call serious music or art music in a sense requires maybe a little more it's generally going to be less repetitive.
Okay.
So I think it perhaps engages, like, you have to be a little more engaged with it perhaps.
Cool.
I'm not sure exactly. I don't know. It appeals to me.
Sure.
And it appeals to certain people, and I don't know how to make it, like, appealing to.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do about, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much, Chuck, for sharing
Thank
the way
you.
That jazz has been bringing together the community here. Jazz Jam is at 7 p.m. on the last Wednesday of each month at Cultivate 712 in downtown Waco. This episode will be posted on kwbu.org. You can also visit creativewaco.org/blog for a recap of my time with Chuck. Catch the next episode of Conversations with Creative Waco on Friday, February 22nd at 11:30 a.m. and 8 o'clock p.m. This has been Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU-FM. I'm your host, Ray Jefferson. Thanks for tuning in.